Tan Sri, Dato, Tato, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, if we might begin, it's just on 10 o'clock. It is my privilege to welcome you all to ISIS, another international affairs seminar. This morning, we have with us a good friend. He's been with the council now for more than a decade.
Correct.
Yeah. So he's been in and out. He's a regular visitor. He knows ASEAN countries very well. And you'd be surprised. He can actually get into quite a few doors and rooms in all the ASEAN capitals. Today, however, we're not here so much, at least I don't think we are, to talk about ASEAN, but rather in terms of what has been happening in terms of the U.S. Midterm elections and what these elections mean for the Asia Pacific and also for Malaysia. I think most of you would be aware of the general things about what happened in the U.S. Midterm elections, but I think Mark can help us to drill down into personalities, you know, committees and things like that. So, and I think that's going to be very helpful in terms of our work. Mark's CV is in here if you don't already know who he is, so please. In the meantime, I would not take up any more time. I'll invite him to address us for about, what, 30 minutes or 35 minutes, 40 minutes?
As long as I can.
Okay. All right. And then, but we want to save at least for about half an hour, sure, because of back and forth. So, gentlemen, can I ask you to, well, good morning to you, and can I ask you all to please welcome Mark Mealy as a speaker.
We're starting with a photo
session.
Okay. Okay, that's it. No more photo opportunities. After. Please.
Stephen, and thank you. Good morning. Welcome. And good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It is good to be here at ISIS. For some of you who don't know, I've had the honor and pleasure of working, I guess, in the U.S.-Malaysia space for over a decade now. Actually beginning really in my time as a former congressional staffer on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, where I actually had the first opportunity to come to Malaysia, and actually even to come to ISIS and to get to know that chairman at that time, Dr. Norden Sopi, in fact, during that time, and who became someone that I really had a chance to learn a great deal from over the many, many years. So it's always good to get to come back to Malaysia and to spend time here at ISIS. As oftentimes, let me indicate right up front that the views that I will share are those of my own personal opinion. They do not reflect the views of the organization that employs me. But as one might say, if you live in Washington and you spend time in sort of those policy circles, as a former congressional staffer, hopefully some of my perspectives can be helpful and can fuel a good conversation after we are finished today. So what I have to do is, one, offer, I guess, a survey of some various pundits and analysts have sort of offered about what the impact of the midterm elections are potentially likely to be on U.S. foreign policy, on President Obama's administration's final 2 years. Offer a few thoughts, my own opinions on some of the scenarios and what they could mean for, I guess, our government's policy of the pivot or rebalance towards Asia. And what that might mean for U.S.-Malaysia relations going forward, which I think we all recognize are right now at a very, very positive and high level in terms of our bilateral relationship right now at the G2G level and also at the business-to-business level. And I think we are well poised to see that bilateral relationship continue to move in very positive directions going forward, particularly since the president will be back here in Malaysia next year. And I think that is very positive. And then lastly, I did want to offer a few thoughts in terms of how the business community in particular is looking to engage the government of Malaysia, but also other stakeholders as Malaysia takes on the role of ASEAN chairman going into 2015, which has become an important part of the conversation and discourse that the business community is now having with Malaysia, given the importance of 2015 and obviously the launching of the AEC at the end of next year. So starting off, looking at some of the impacts of the midterms, all of you, I'm sure, know the Republican Party now has the majority in two of the three houses of Congress, houses or branches of our government in terms of the Congress and the Senate. And that's a bit of a shift from what President Obama has had to navigate, where the Dems did formally control the Senate. And I think if you read folks, you talk to different analysts or what have you, we do kind of get the full gamut of perspectives as to what this could mean going forward. I think you could start on one side with the potential for a continuation of what some call gridlock, a continuation of sort of the partisanship that has kind of characterized the relationship between the administration and the Congress. That is certainly a potential scenario. I think it does, for those who are sort of arguing on that side of the equation, it raises the question or purports that with the Republicans now having a grip more power in terms of the Congress and the Senate, it becomes a question of how they will choose to exercise that power. Will they try to use that power to continue to strengthen maybe their hand come the 2016 presidential elections and therefore look for opportunities to oppose some of the ideas or the initiatives that President Obama wants to look forward to? Or will they, in a sense, say, you know what, now that we have a bit more power in the government, there's a bit more onus on us to demonstrate we have the ability to govern and actually not just simply sort of be the opposition party, so to speak. And the potential there is obviously where might there be opportunities for some deals to be struck between the Republican-controlled House and Senate and the White House going forward. So I mean, that's obviously one side. And it does kind of segue, I think, in terms of the foreign policy dimension, if you're looking at it in terms of you know, what does this really mean for foreign policy? Most of the, I guess, you know, analysts and pundits in Washington are all kind of teeing up that the elections, this last midterm election, number one, normally foreign policy is not really a major sort of domestic political issue in the United States. And usually it's not a big political issue during the midterm elections. This most recent election, a little bit different, where foreign policy issues were much more on the front burner of some of the campaigns. And if you think about it, it was, I think, just as a voter and as a citizen, you certainly saw a lot more discussion around the situation vis-a-vis Russia as, quote-unquote, a failure of U.S. foreign policy right now, therefore, and therefore part of the campaign critique between Republicans against Democrats. You certainly saw the sort of the rise of ISIS in Iraq and in Syria as, again, a campaign kind of issue. Again, Republican candidates using that reality as a way of attacking and critiquing the Democrats in the campaign. Particularly, for example, we all know there was a series of executions that were, obviously our media made that very information very much aware to much more of the average American voter that maybe normally, you know, wouldn't know where Iraq was, so to speak, and why would they even care about the vis-a-vis an election. But much more, you know, sort of in front and center stage. You certainly also saw, even more recently, leading to, you saw the whole Ebola crisis in West Africa almost become, again, part of the political discourse. You know, somehow, again, that was a failure. There's some kind of failure for U.S. foreign policy not doing enough to protect the safety of Americans, so to speak, from, you know, a potential global pandemic emanating from Africa, so to speak. So these kinds of sort of foreign policy questions were, for me, were much more prevalent during the midterm elections than I think you would normally imagine. And so I think in response to that, or after the election, many analysts are saying, you know, with the Republicans now, House and Senate, there's going to be a stronger push to pretend, let's say, address those failures, address those sort of weaknesses, you know, on U.S. foreign policy led by President Obama, and therefore pushing for a more stronger or more robust kind of sort of U.S. foreign policy activity or presence, you know, being tougher. you know, maybe more sanctions against Russia, maybe more direct military engagement in confronting the threat of ISIS in Iraq. You know, maybe some in the Hill might be talking about maybe we should have soldiers, you know, or more more direct involvement in the situation in Syria. So these are some of the kinds of things you're hearing, at least in terms of rhetoric, first and foremost. But you are hearing these kinds of things being talked about post-elections, so to speak. So I think that kind of offers two different spectrums of some of the foreign policy perspectives that one might offer. Now, if I were to say, okay, well, what is it? What potentially from that spectrum do Mark, do you think, you know, right, really emerge? In other words, is there potential for more finding common ground on some issues between Republicans and Democrats? Will President Obama, I think, have to recognize that, yeah, there's been some failures or some weaknesses in terms of how his administration has tried to handle certain foreign policy questions? I think we can say a few things have happened already. First and foremost, you would say, does the resignation of Defense Secretary Hagel indicate a bit of a reflection that maybe some things have not been handled properly? Maybe there is some need for change, so to speak, from the defense and security side of things. One might say, on the other side, and I'm being a bit of a devil's advocate here, that if there was going to be, you know, a desire for finding a bit more common ground working together, there were those who would argue when the president decided to move forward using executive authority on immigration, that was a clear shot that, you know what, I'm still going to work on the things and push hard on the things that I care about, even if I no longer have the majority in both the Congress and the Senate, so to speak. And we already saw, as soon as that was done, immediately a bit of a back and forth backlash between the Republicans and Democrats on the president's decision to use that authority, so to speak. So I think there's probably no, you know, crystal ball, so to speak, of how some of these machinations will play out, although I think there are some areas where there are some potential for deals and really getting some things done. Before I even offer a few thoughts on that, let me just say that I think it is important, and I know, again, as a citizen, none of these kind of things are going on in a vacuum. And I think there are a few broader backdrops that one, I think, would want to take into account and maybe trying to think through how, you know, politicians on both sides of the aisle may want to work through some of these new realities on the foreign policy questions. I think I was just talking to Stephen earlier. Many of you probably know that on questions of race relations in the United States, which has always been a common thread in our society and the political dimension, we're at a pretty, let's say, a low period right now in America, given a series of recent events that have happened, decisions by courts, counter moves by the federal level of government vis-a-vis states. You all have probably seen there's been protests in different cities around the country in response to certain incidents that have happened. This is something which, again, maybe because there's been sort of a confluence of a series of activities in a similar compressed period of time, but I think it would be very naive to think politically that this is not a relevant context for trying to understand how politicians may have to make certain choices and decisions about where they might want to be focusing their energy on, things they might want to be working together. Because one will always, I think, keep in mind, some of these issues can have political implications, again, going towards 2016. So I think the current situation of where we are in terms of the discourse around race in America is an important context right now. I think we should never forget the fact that we're never looking at politics in the absence of a vacuum around the economy. And there are a number of both challenges as well as opportunities that the U.S. economy is facing that are always in the backs of the minds of citizens, which means they're generally also relevant for politicians as well. So as we've seen in a lot of countries around the world, the U.S. is going through an interesting discourse right now about sort of the rise in income inequality in the United States, degrees of joblessness or unemployment, even though the economy has been growing. One has, you know, many economists say it's been growing, but the, how should we say, the fruits of the recovery don't seem to be very broad-based. And even though we have seen some improvements in consumer confidence in recent years, the most, you know, we're right now in quote unquote the beginning of major heavy consumption shopping season in America right now. And I think the first reports from the big, you know, in America, we do this big thing after our Thanksgiving holiday where we literally kill ourselves to go buy things at 2 and 3 in the morning. The initial reports were that sales were about 10% lower than in previous years, which one might say, is that an indication of, again, a certain degree of economic uncertainty on the minds of lots of consumers. We've also got some other headwinds that are still out there. Debt, those kinds of things. Again, these are contexts, I think, for how we might want to try to understand some of the political implications of the midterm elections. Because again, I think they will feed into how we assess the impact of these midterms. And then lastly, again, my opinion here, I often find, and this is not anything unique to the United States, but you know, in societies where you know you're potentially, you know, facing very low approval ratings of government, which our Congress has been notoriously a victim of for a number of years, where there are domestic interest concerns that have been challenging, it's not surprising that some of the foreign policy kinds of questions sometimes get moved to the forefront. Sometimes politicians see, actually, that can be a way of really unifying maybe the country around certain bigger issues, and perhaps sometimes taking a little bit less of the focus on some of the domestic challenges, which we maybe haven't quite figured out politically how to really address. And I think that kind of really maybe segues to the heart of this question about what are some of the potential impacts in foreign policy, where are there potential opportunities for movement, maybe breaking some of the gridlock, and then potentially where are there not opportunities. I think where I would start, again, and this is from my days of working in the Congress. For the record, I worked on the Democratic side of the aisle as a congressional staffer. We were in the minority during those years, so we did spend a lot of time being a loyal opposition to the majority. That was our role during those years. But I think there I'm actually, you know, someone that is somewhat optimistic about the potential for actually, you know, breaking through of some of the gridlock. So I guess I kind of come down on, I think there is potential for a little bit less partisanship going forward and a little less gridlock going forward and potentially maybe getting some things done in a bit more of a bipartisan way going forward. And I offer my thoughts why. But I think where I kind of start from and why I see there's a potential for in a sense, for deals between both parties, is that, you know, the 2016 basically campaign is already starting, okay? I mean, as soon as we finish this midterm, it's like no break for the campaign process. We're actually now really getting on the way of the presidential campaigns. And I think both parties, at the end of the day, when they're trying to both govern, but also thinking ahead, are thinking about in terms of, you know, are there areas where they can move forward and maybe claim some successes? And the question, I think, that sort of that political calculation, you know, I think personally, President Obama's decision to move forward sort of using executive authority on immigration is a good example of thinking about 2016 and that constituency group that's a potential strong voting base for those campaigns. I think politically that made a lot of sense. And even if it might mean, oh, just when we thought maybe we could start working together, you're now moving in a direction where we're not going to be with you. So do the Republicans sort of say, well, see, this shows he's not really willing to work together. He's doing this kind of using executive authority and as opposed to a bipartisan approach. I think that's a calculation the president made. But I think it goes to this age-old thing of, well, both parties make calculations between working together on some things to get some things done to govern, vis-a-vis if there are successes, does it offer a success for my party, or is my, in a sense, future opponent come 2016, are they able to sort of claim the success? And I think both parties will probably think carefully about what are some of the areas where they will look to do deals on, because they both can claim success on. Perhaps there may be some areas, though, where one side might say, you know, if we work together on that area, Yeah, the other guy's going to be able to claim more of the credits and then really use it for their advantage come 2016. And that might therefore not be an area to maybe work together on. I think that's one of the realities about shaping deals. A couple of reasons why I think, though, that, and I'll start here with why I think there's an opportunity to move forward, and particularly in terms of foreign policy. Some examples on both sides of the aisle. Number one, very glad to see that the chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Chairman Royce, is going to maintain that position. Chairman Royce actually was someone before he was chairman that I actually had a chance to work with, again, in a bipartisan way when I worked on the Hill many, many, many years ago. And personally, I think Chairman Royce, his demeanor, and sort of the temperature which he sort of approaches some of the foreign policy questions, as a Republican chairman, are, my opinion, rational, logical, doesn't really go to the extreme on either side, even, quote-unquote, you say that maybe those who are far to the right of his own party. In other words, the right kind of person to really look seriously at certain foreign policy questions. And the fact that, again, that he's going to maintain that chairmanship, I think, is quite positive. Another dimension of that is he's actually, in his first term as chairman, demonstrated a real interest in ASEAN. And he's actually come out to the region on several occasions. And I think that's also very positive that he'll maintain that position and hopefully maintain that level of interest in terms of the U.S. Foreign policy efforts in Southeast Asia. I think that's quite positive. I think we could also note, I guess maybe anecdotally, that the way that the Republican-controlled Congress on the House side finally sort of wrapped up this whole Benghazi affair issue or investigation or what have you, in a sense, putting it to bed, bringing sort of an end to extremist one play partisan politics with it and, you know, kind of run with it, et cetera, I think is also a positive sign that maybe within the Republican Party, there really is an effort to move a bit more towards the center of the party and try to move forward on some things vis-a-vis, let's say, their extreme right wing of their party. I find that very positive. I mentioned before, the resignation of Senator Hagel. One might say that's a recognition. Things have not gone well. There's a need for change. As a good manager, I think that says, okay, President Obama is open or looking to maybe do some things differently, maybe have some different people in certain jobs. I think that could be seen also as a positive sign that there is some ways that maybe we can move forward on a couple of areas. Let me switch to my second set of remarks or thoughts on where I think there's some deal opportunities. I think on the questions of trade, and this kind of really swings into more of the heat of the conversation. What does this sort of really mean for the pivot, rebalancing, and U.S. foreign policy towards Asia? I think in the era of trade, there really is an opportunity for a bipartisan deal to move forward on that front that didn't really exist literally 2 or 3 months ago. Obviously, the reconfiguration post-midterms, you've got, in a sense, that by the Democrats sort of taking a beating at the polls, you've got certain wings of the Democratic Party that have kind of been in the opposition side, I think, to the president's maybe personal interests or just thinking it's the right thing to do to move forward on trade. I think that's less of a constraint for him right now in terms of trying to push forward on the two big trade initiatives, TPP and also TTIP. I think on the Republican side, Republicans, you would say, generally historically known to be a bit more pro-business. So the fact that if they're in the control of both the House and the Senate, are they now prepared, as an example, to demonstrate a willingness to govern versus being in the opposition to move forward vis-a-vis and provide the president with a bill that would give him trade promotion authority? I think there's a real opportunity there. And I guess you say if the first couple of salvos, you know, on this whole discussion, a lot of my friends, both Republican, pretty well on the Republican side, I have a former colleague who used to work at the council and now works at the Heritage Foundation, which for those you know is more of a considered a conservative think tank. You know, been kind of hammering the president, why don't you move forward and really make a case for trade promotion authority and that these trade agreements are good for America? You know, what's holding you back? And there was a speech the president gave last week where, in a sense, he says, I'm going to begin making this case. I'm going to start moving forward with both talking to Democrats about why getting trade promotion authority is important and doing TPP is important. He did, however, say it's not going to be an easy struggle because he knows there are still folks in his own party that are not going to stand with him. And as we also know, there are also folks in the Republican Party that do not support giving this president trade promotion authority. I mean, even TP in general, but definitely not this president trade promotion authority, and maybe have concerns about free trade. So there'll be an interesting little alliance, because if you look at the trade debate right now in Washington, the opposition side is a quote-unquote a big tent. It consists of folks on both the left and the right that, in a sense, are stating their opposition to trade promotion authority and moving forward on TPP. That being the case, I personally think that means there's an opportunity for a deal in the middle for the president and like-minded Republicans to basically get this thing done, so to speak. It'll be interesting to see, just looking forward. You know, this kind of goes into some of the weeds here, but the current chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Senator Wyden, did have a bill that would provide the president with trade promotion authority. The incoming chairman, Senator Hatch, has kind of said, I'm going to sit down, Senator, and talk with you and maybe see if there's some things from your bill that you would like basically to include when I bring up a bill in terms of having a Senate version of trade promotion authority. I think what it really kind of boils down to, just for those who may be really looking at this issue, so for the Democrats, there are a couple of things that they would like to have included in the trade promotion authority bill. But obviously, now that they're no longer in the majority, there's no guarantee that those things will be in there once a bill is eventually created. But for example, they wanted things like further funding for our program called the Trade Adjustment Assistance Act. Okay, additional funding for that. That's generally been something which Democrats have always tried to weave into support for trade. And historically, Republicans have sometimes been for it, sometimes been against it, so to speak. It'll be interesting to see if, as they negotiate sort of a new version of this bill, if TAA is included in the package or not, so to speak. The other thing I think one could also just wonder hypothetically, given the fact that Republicans know the president would like a bill, he has said, I would like TPA, it'll be interesting to see if both the House and Senate majorities would just work together just to give him a straightforward TPA bill. Just give him a bill that you know he'll sign, so to speak, and be done with it. Or will they try to include certain things in it that maybe the president doesn't really want? Again, this is where you look again sometimes how, again, does the partisan nature of politics, can it come into play even when there's an opportunity for a deal? I can tell you as someone that works with the business community, let's be very, very clear where the business community stands. They want to see a deal. And they will, I think, work very aggressively to make sure that if there's a way of putting forward, you know, a straightforward TPA bill, don't try to play partisan politics with it and throw other things in it just because you want to force the president's hand on something else. That's where the business community will aggressively use its lobbying efforts to really say, let's just move forward in a way that's good for the country and not be tied up with, let's say, certain extreme perspectives on either side, so to speak. But it'll be something to keep an eye on. I think USCR Foreman, in a talk I guess he gave this week, has talked about that he believes TPA and TPP can be done during the year of 2015. I think that's a rational and legitimate approach, because I think if you go beyond 2015, we're much, much too close for the U.S. presidential elections in 2016, where historically neither political party likes to make their candidates, including the president, have to have a trade bill or a big trade vote to be part of the political debate, because usually candidates from both sides lose or it gets used against them in their own particular races. So I think 2015 is really the political opportunity for the U.S. government to move forward on Trade Promotion Authority, TPP, et cetera. And I think that's the nature of where you'll see a lot of the efforts, government, business, to really work towards that kind of opportunity. I think, again, there is a real great success there. I mean, the other piece that I was noted about sort of the, you know, what this may mean vis-a-vis for Asia, I'd say one last thing about TPP. I think as we're moving forward, I think finally getting our, you know, sort of ducks in a row so that the U.S. government can successfully bring the deal to a close. I think we all have to be cognizant of the fact there still are concerns and issues among some of our trade partners on some of the elements of the package. I know Malaysia has concerns still. Our friends in Vietnam have concerns still. And so I think as someone who's watching this sort of on both sides of the water, I'm actually particularly focused on, and maybe we can talk about a little bit today, on how some of the sort of the domestic politics are playing out, particularly in Japan, Malaysia, in terms of TPP, and where the leaders of those two countries are, in a sense, looking to strike a balance, I think, between successfully moving forward on TPP, but at the same time, not make it a zero-sum game where they then lose politically. I think we've already seen with Prime Minister Abe call for a snap election. I think politically there's some kind of calculation there that a reconfigured parliament might be a bit more politically conducive for the Prime Minister's government to move forward on TPP, because as we all know, there's some very tough domestic political questions or issues that Japanese politicians are going to have to, in a sense, either move forward or decide to move forward on or not, in terms of the commitments that are being sought in that negotiation. Those of us here in Malaysia, we know there has always been some politically sensitive issues that the government of Malaysia has wrestled with, in terms of, we were talking earlier, that even go back to our effort even to do a bilateral FTA. We've made tremendous progress since then. I mean, there were issues back in those days that the government of Malaysia wouldn't even talk about. In other words, sorry, we can't even discuss those issues. The government of Malaysia has made tremendous progress in terms of, yeah, we can negotiate on that issue. We're willing to put that issue on the table, so to speak, and can be part of the negotiations. Doesn't mean, though, that there aren't still political challenges for Prime Minister Najib's government. I think his government, my observation, very, very clear, wants to move forward, wants to see a deal done. And at the end of the day, negotiations are about the give and take and trying to find the best possible deal that probably at the end of the day gives something for everyone and probably makes everyone a little bit disappointed. It's probably the art of a successful agreement. But I think we are all, again, recognizing that it's not just simply about what happens in the United States that will dictate that. And I think looking ahead for the region, again, I think we talk about this a lot at the Business Council. And again, I'm still speaking for myself, but we always hide the fact that a lot of the pivot and rebalancing towards Asia policy runs through Southeast Asia. You know, I think a lot of Americans don't oftentimes understand that. They, you know, might think it's vis-a-vis Japan or, you know, U.S.-China policy. But a lot of what the policy is about really has an ASEAN centrality principle to it and focus to it, and just really gives the importance for this region. I think post-midterms, there's a couple of things that all of us who are looking at this might want to keep our eyes on, so to speak. Again, I'm not in the government, but having spent some time with some folks on the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee recently, obviously the current situation in Thailand is something which our government is, in a sense, wrestling with in terms of how to properly calibrate that important treaty relationship, but at the same time recognizing that the current political situation is not very conducive for let's say, a further growing and enhancing of the G2G relationship. So I think that's one thing we'll certainly keep our eye on. I think very interesting debate going on right now about Myanmar and how sort of the domestic reform process in the country is progressing. We all know in life, very few things are linear. We see things, you know, one step forward, two steps back, progress in some areas, challenges in other areas. There are folks in the U.S. That are watching the sort of watching not only developments there, but really watching, you know, U.S. foreign policy engagement with Myanmar. And it'll be interesting to kind of see how they sort of maintain their observations. I did have a good friend of mine who serves on, again, the staff of the Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, who hinted to me that because there's a few senators who, you know, really do care about Myanmar, that they may always sort of try to bring it up if they see things not going very well, vis-a-vis the constitutional question about whether Aung San Suu Kyi will be able to stand for election or not. And I had one Senate staffer even remind me the fact that, again, all politics sometimes can be local, depending upon if certain candidates decide to stand for election in 2016, might be interesting to see if U.S. policy towards Myanmar becomes a political campaign issue, which, again, what you would not normally think that would really matter, but there are some who highlight the fact that there may be some who want to attach that question to certain candidates, you know, come 2016. So it might be interesting to kind of sort of keep an eye on how overall, I think there's a very good piece in The Economist or another public I just read today, a really, I think, a sane perspective in terms of how our government, our business should really think about progress, challenges, and engaging Myanmar going forward. So I think that's going to be one of those where there'll be a continued discourse in the United States about that. And then thirdly, I would highlight, I believe that one other country post-midterm elections where, again, there'll be an interesting discussion going on, which I think right now it's primarily a very positive discussion, but has the potential, is really the continued, you know, growth and development of sort of U.S.-Vietnam bilateral engagement. Obviously, Vietnam being in TPP makes for a very positive opportunity to really strengthen the bilateral economic relationship. There has been growth in terms of the mill-to-mill relationship between our two countries. And I think the last but not least, the movement on the nuclear relationship, which usually any time you're talking about, you know, nuclear power relations, civilian relations, that obviously elevates to a certain level of status. And I think, you know, the U.S.-Vietnam relationship in that space does offer good opportunities to really strengthen the relationship in that regard. I'm actually very excited about a number of things that I'm seeing in Vietnam in terms of some of the economic and business things that are ongoing. At the same time, we should not keep in mind there are those voices in Congress that are very concerned about human rights, labor rights, political freedoms, those kinds of things. And again, one can imagine those will be part of the discussions that will take place on the Hill, particularly if there's efforts to further strengthen the bilateral relationship. So I think that will be something to keep in mind post this midterm. Let me close with just a few thoughts on sort of the third point I wanted to highlight, which was some of the conversations that that we've been having both with Malaysia, but also even within the region about, you know, Malaysia taking on the role of ASEAN chair going into 2015, and obviously tied to the launching of the AEC on December 31st, or the more formal launching of it. Very, very, very excited to have Malaysia as chair of ASEAN going forward. Think there are big opportunities and big potential gains that Malaysia's leadership, if it can be deployed effectively, can really significantly move the ball forward in terms of the AEC. Again, recognizing that obviously one never knows what, you know, what will, you know, happen in terms of domestic politics, but I think the Prime Minister's articulated vision for some of the things that Malaysia wants to really focus on and champion are spot on. And I think there's going to be fantastic opportunities for collaboration and looking for partnering, both with our bilateral G2G relationship, as well as, I think, with the business community relationship. So, for example, I think in terms of the G2G relationship, the fact that we're already working as part of our elevated relationship in terms of our comprehensive partnership, I think there's opportunities to work together in some of the third country sort of relationships. So, you know, U.S., Malaysia, and others maybe working together to maybe support the process in Myanmar. Is a great opportunity for using our enhanced bilateral relationship to work in third country space. I think if Malaysia's got things it really wants to champion vis-a-vis ASEAN and the AEC, I think the United States, as part of, again, the pivot and rebalancing and wanting to really engage ASEAN, would be very open to saying where there might be areas, whether it's working on things like human capital development, whether it's the working on some of the closing of development gaps between the more advanced ASEAN countries and the less advanced. I think these are all areas that are quite ripe for partnerships. And you actually have seen examples where our government has really invested resources. I was in Singapore yesterday. Actually, my organization held a forum on human capital and 21st century skills development in ASEAN because we believe that, you know, there's probably four or five things that if ASEAN really gets right in the movement of the AEC, it will really enhance the benefits for all 10 countries in the region. So whether you're talking about if ASEAN can get the ASEAN single window right, that will be very, very significant for all 10 countries in the region. There are a number of American companies that believe there needs to be a clear elevation of the discussions around policies and investments and really strengthening human capital in all 10 countries and skills development in all 10 countries. Recognizing, obviously, different countries at different levels of development, it's not quite the same challenge in each country, but nonetheless, improvements in productivity, making sure that people have access to education, particularly on questions of gender, so women and girls having access to education at the sort of higher level to make sure that graduates of college and university have the skills to really enter the workplace, which I know has sometimes been a challenge here in Malaysia. Malaysia produces great graduates with strong technical skills, but oftentimes they need additional sort of skills in terms of, let's say, their English language proficiency, being able to collaborate, critical thinking, those soft skills are the kinds of things that we talked about yesterday. But my main point being, and the reason why I want to bring this up as an example, one of the things that we did as part of this forum yesterday was we actually brought in over 60 young ASEAN professionals and students from all 10 ASEAN countries that are all fellows in the YSEALI initiative, which is the Young Southeast Asia Leaders Initiative that our government is supporting, which to me is a fantastic example of sort of the U.S. government's commitment to not only the people-to-people relationship, but really saying we really want to work with and help work with the next generation of ASEAN young people from all 10 countries. And so we were able to include these young professionals in this conversation around education, skills development, and entering the workforce. So you had business, you had academic community, you had government, and you also had young people to really be part of a conversation. I think these, again, are some of the areas where I think at the G2G level there's great potential. And then from the business community side, the conversations that we've been having with different stakeholders in the government of Malaysia, but also even the corporate community, we really think if Malaysia can leverage its chairmanship year and its leadership in a couple of areas, not only will the region benefit, but I think the government will find some public-private partnership opportunities. First one that we've been talking about with the government is in the area of ICT. Malaysia's been very successful at building a very innovative-driven ecosystem to support ICT. It's why Penang, you know, is the Silicon Valley of East Asia. It's why lots of companies, global IT companies, have investments here. It's why 10 years ago when they were just simply doing assembly, now they're doing R&D here. There's a lot of great lessons, examples of good policies, good regulations, that if Malaysia could, how should we say, help inculcate some of those similar approaches to other countries in the region, that would be well received and would be very much supported. Second area that we've been talking about with the government is an area of sort of SME development. I think, again, the World Bank and many others have recognized Malaysia as one of the best ecosystems for SME development in the world, given the kinds of institutions that have been put in place, policies and regulations, etc. We believe that if, again, Malaysia can maybe help transfer some of those kinds of approaches to other countries so that they could improve their domestic and business environments to help their SMEs to grow and develop, that would be quite positive. And again, we'd probably be well received and potential partners with many U.S. companies that are also actively working to support SME development. And then last but not least, I would mention a third area that we've been talking about. It fits into, obviously, the ASEAN Master Plan on Connectivity, but we believe that in the area of infrastructure development, again, Malaysia, I think, is quite proud and quite successful in terms of building infrastructure here in Malaysia, role of the private sector, having the kinds of policies in place that attract both private capital as well as government capital in the supporting infrastructure development. Once again, Malaysia home to the ASEAN Infrastructure Fund, so already kind of playing a regional role in supporting infrastructure development in the region. We think that, again, can be a very important area where Malaysia's leadership could really help move the AEC forward. At the end of the day, we know 2015 is not the end all, of course. It's really just the beginning. We know there are already discussions in Malaysia about what is going to be the post-2015 AEC agenda. Very important. I think that can be part of Malaysia's sort of legacy to the AEC process from its chairmanship year to really hand off a tangible, forward-looking plan that stakeholders can work with, you know, our friends from Laos who will be the next chairman, but business, government, other stakeholders can really kind of push that post-2015 agenda forward. Will be, again, I think, an important contribution for Malaysia's chairmanship year. And again, the business community is very eager to find ways to be supportive of that agenda. So with that, I would like to come to a close, and I look forward to our conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.